aspects of the human condition I knew instinctively, but had trouble articulating. Proust understood the conflicting ways we perceive reality and come to our own peculiar self-serving truths. He illuminated human folly with its illusions, ambiguities, and contradictions. He reminded his readers that empathy is the most important virtue in life, especially for the vulnerable. He explored the fragility of human goodness, the seduction and hollowness of power and social status, the inconsistency of the human heart, racism, especially anti-Semitism, and our looming mortality, which hovers over every page, as it did for the sickly Proust, as he struggled to finish his masterpiece, dictating changes on the last night he was alive in his hermetically sealed, cork-lined bedroom in Paris. Those who see in his work a retreat from the world are poor readers of Proust, for his power is his Freudian understanding of the unconscious and subterranean forces that define and shape human existence. There are very few writers who are his equal. Joining me to discuss Marcel Proust's In Search of Lost Time is Justin E. H. Smith, a professor of history and the philosophy of science at the University of Paris. The main belt asteroid 13585 Justin Smith is named after him. You can find him on Substack at Justin E. H. Smith's internet. So, Justin, the passage of time haunts the novel, especially at the end. It exposes, as we age, as the characters age, the vanity of our youthful pretensions. I think this is true for most of the characters, including Burma, who's a thinly disguised Sarah Bernhardt, abandoned by her admirers in her old age, or the main courtesan Odette, the Passion of Swan, and the Comte de Forcheville, who was once a beauty and a seductress who enchanted certainly male Paris, is in the end relegated to the corner of her daughter's salon, where she's ignored, even ridiculed. And Proust writes about Odette, and this woman adulated and worshipped her whole life, now a human wreck in formal dress and grand toilette, looks out alarmed and bewildered at the ferocious social world and seems to me for the first time likable. So I wondered if you could address time, the passage of time, and its effects, which is certainly one of the themes that is central to Proust's novel.
Absolutely. Thanks, Chris. I know you want to talk about Proust and philosophy later, but I think it's hard, at least for me, to talk about time without engaging at least a bit with the question of Proust's relationship to philosophy, in particular to the reflections on the nature of time as something experienced that are unfolding in the early 20th century, of which Proust is, I would say, vaguely aware, interested. I wouldn't call him a dabbler. I would call him a thorough reader who is also intelligent enough to absorb reflections from phenomenology, from figures like Husserl, from Henri Bergson's philosophy of time, and to translate this into something that, on the face of it, is a sort of autofiction. It's an autofiction, but it's also a philosophy of time. For me, that really only becomes clear, or the payoff really only emerges in the seventh and final volume, Le Temps Retrouvé, the time regained, as we usually translate it. And this is, it's funny that you mentioned your coverage of the war in Bosnia in the 1990s and your encounter with Proust in the context of war, because for me, it's the ravages of World War I that are recounted in the seventh volume that really make us understand what it means for the things we value to slip into the past and for our world to collapse. So obviously, throughout the previous six volumes, there are the, let's say, gentler ravages of time with La Berma getting old and wrinkly, and of course also the several little deaths of falling out of love with the people he has at least thought he was in love with. That's debatable, and we can get back to that. And also, of course, the more kind of signature moments of the Madeleine and the tea and the unsolicited memories that come back to us that make us realize what's been lost. But nothing makes this clearer than his kind of ghost-like stalking throughout Paris when there are curfews because of the air raids, and his sense that everything is really in the past. And of course, the real Proust, not the narrator, but the real Proust, during World War I, already surely has a sharp sense of his own declining health and his own, let's say, near ghost status already. So that's where it really comes through to my mind. And that's where we start getting le ton, capitalized with a big capital T, and his kind of, so to speak, discovery of time as something approaching a transcendent or divine, worshipable and awesome and terrible entity, right? That's the culmination of the previous six volumes. And one thing that's so striking about À la Recherche is the way that there's often, for the most important themes, a very slow build up, and that where you only realize the full depth or the full awesomeness of the theme he's exploring little by little. And that is above all the case with time. But we can talk more about this when we get back to philosophy.
Well, so let's just stay on that, because there's two. When I read the last volume, they were like depth charges, and you really needed everything that came before to get there. He talks a lot about masks. I think death pervades the entire novel. But can you just address that issue of masks, which he suddenly becomes cognizant of at the end?
Yeah. Well, especially, I mean, it's especially haunting when we think of Man Ray's famous photograph of Proust on his deathbed, when he's grown a long beard. And, you know, he's very close to death, and he has a face that looks, very much, as Proust himself puts it, like Marcel Proust, the Assyrian, right? Kind of very dark, a very, stark nose that looks like something sculpted in deep antiquity. And, I don't know if Man Ray is trying to, show in a visual form, this notion of mask that had become so important to Proust. But it's, certainly, an important, datum in our reflection on Proust and masks. But also, of course, the example that you bring up of La Berma, the famous actress, modeled, broadly on Sarah Bernhardt, who is such a focus of Proust's, or of the narrator's, fascination and adoration in his youth. And of course, he already loses the fascination long before she has been relegated to a corner of her daughter's salon. You know, he loses it when he goes, and this is one of my favorite scenes in the whole novel, when he watches her perfect gestures on stage, and he contemplates the fact that there are parts of the actress's body, like, for example, between the wrist and the elbow, over which the actress has no control. So this part of my arm cannot be transfigured by art, no matter how great a genius artist I am. And Proust sees this on the stage and loses it, right? Basically, he thinks, why was I so impressed by La Verma? She's got a forearm just like I do. And it's such a weird thing to discover, or at least to articulate, but Proust does it. And of course, this has something to do with the whole novel's long reflection on, let's say, the relationship between art and life. Ordinarily, you couldn't put a mask on a forearm. That's not the sort of thing that is masked, but it is still the sort of thing that shows the limits of transfiguration by art. And then when she is elderly and relegated to a corner of her daughter's salon and evidently overly made up as some old women who are not going gently into the good night often are, this is literally a mask. It's cosmetics or mascara that are kind of showing the futility of the fight against against time, and ultimately, I suppose, showing the futility of struggling to live in a world that is perpetually transfiguration in the name of art against death, right? Something like that.
Well, he's constantly uncovering masks. I mean, he holds up from the beginning, the Guermont, and he idolizes the elite, and these turn out to be very banal. Disappointing figures. I think there's an undercurrent of disillusionment that runs constantly throughout the book. We are going to have to talk about the Petit Madeleine. I loathe mentioning it. It's the sort of one thing
you gotta do. Knows you gotta about do it. Yeah.
But I mean, this kind of unconscious, involuntary memory, and it's not just with Madeleine the tea, but there are many examples of this, that, evoke, the past. I wondered if you could, these dim fragments, these, brief, flashes of recognition and, in an unexamined life, which keeps that life fragmented, unknown, devoid of context. And I just wondered if, how for Proust, do we locate the past? How do we give it context? And then if you can talk about the importance of involuntary memory and illuminating the reality of experience. I'm just going to read a little quote from Proust. Quote, "I find the Celtic belief very reasonable that the souls of those we have lost are held captive in some inferior creature and an animal and a plant and some inanimate thing effectively lost to us until the day which for many never comes, when we happen to pass close to the tree, come into possession of the object that is their prison. Then they quiver, they call out to us, and as soon as we have recognized them, the spell is broken. Delivered by us, they have overcome death, and they return to live with us." So that's a lot, but maybe you can address those issues.
Oh yeah, can I say something first about unmasking? The last thing we were talking about. Yeah, I mean, one of the most striking parts of the whole novel for me is the scene when we know Swann is dying and he comes to the home of the de Guermantes, and the Duke and his wife, Bazin and Oriane, are leaving for some social engagement, and she's worried about which shoes to wear, and basically he's trying to tell them he's dying and they're not going to see him anymore, and they're just chattering back and forth about whether the shoes match the robe. Somehow I always picture that couple, this is my kind of dumb American pop culture orientation, as the Thurston Howell and his wife on Gilligan's Island. It's fascinating indeed the way they are unmasked, taken down so many notches from their early kind of exalted status. And this is why I really hate the commentary by people like Maxim Gorky on Proust, who say that he is a slavish, adoring kind of lackey of the aristocrats. Obviously, that's not all that's going on. This is more like an expose of how base and petty these people are, just like all of us, right? It's definitely not any sort of class consciousness of the sort Gorky would like to see, but it's also not sycophancy towards the nobility. All right, so that's just one thing.
We can go back to let me just stop you there on that scene, because first of all, Gorky ends up becoming a kind of tool of Stalin. So, but he eviscerates the ruling. I don't know how you can read Proust and not see that. I mean,
I don't know.
But just that scene that you pointed out, because they dismiss him, and the way they dismiss Swan is by saying, oh, you're not really that sick. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
And then saying, well, we have to go. We're in a hurry.
Yeah.
And then the Duke sees that his wife's shoes don't match her outfit. And so sends her back inside for a half hour to get another pair of shoes. So they're in the face of death. I mean, I think it kind of says it. Oh, like you, I found that scene haunting, but let's address the other issues.
Yeah, sure, sure. So I have to say, I mean, it's not like my interest in the novel trailed, but I think there's no more powerful part than the opening, maybe third of the first volume of the whole novel, when he is a child and when he is very much a sort of animist, describing the natural milieu of Cambrai, and the flowers and the grass and the weather. And he is very, very good at evoking natural landscapes. And it's in this connection, rather early on, that the allusion to the Celts and their beliefs. I think this comes from Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, where there's some reflection on Druidic religion, and then it becomes a kind of commonplace in French history of ancient peoples of France, that the Druids did indeed believe that we're reincarnated in trees. I see this a lot in 17th century texts. But it's a way for Proust to kind of indulge this proximity to nature, and also to pursue the themes of memory, right? And I love the scenes in the early parts of the novel, particularly surrounding asparagus and the idea that a stalk of asparagus is some kind of nature sprite or fairy that is presumably rooted in northern French folk beliefs. And that it's this supernatural entity in turn that causes the peculiar bouquet, as he would put it, in your urine some hours after you eat asparagus. And it's such an intense engagement with the smells and colors and sensations of nature that he practically goes metempsychotic himself and, you know, inhabits a tree for a while. I just love all that stuff. And I think it's at its strongest in the first volume, where he is, of course, a boy, and you're supposed to get over that when you get older and enter society. So he retreats from the intense engagement with nature as he becomes an adult and leaves behind childish things. But in the particular sequence of images associated with the Celtic or druidic beliefs. I think indeed, the idea seems to be that, in this reduced state, you have a dimmer sense of who you are, and it has to be coaxed back out, in order for the ancestor to rejoin us. And that in a sense, to evoke this image of the soul, lodged in a tree is to, give an account of the condition we are all actually in, where we, where we can scarcely hold on to our pasts and they only come back to us in dim fragments.
I mean, what's interesting is that they do come back to everyone in these, a smell, a sound, something. But Proust, and, here maybe we can talk about art, that those are, while they can evoke the past, they are largely meaningless unless, we are able to interpret them through artistic expression. I don't know if you would agree.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. And of course, he covers, really all of the, let's say, the great arts, not just literature, but also certainly music and painting. These are leitmotifs of the whole novel. And indeed, they do seem to be, the kind of answer to the question, what are these dim fragments of memory for anyway? Well, they can be catalyzed or sublimated into a great musical idea. Like, for example, the phrase in Vinteuil's sonata, that seems to hold the secret to our existence. So indeed, and we really get this towards the very end of the novel, the seventh volume, again, functioning as the payoff for so much of the long-windedness of the whole thing. The realization that the narrator has of himself, that he needs to conjure out of himself something as valuable, as redeeming as Vinteuil's sonata, in order to make this whole lifetime of dim fragmentary memories, do anything for him at all.
I want to talk about the mutation of the self, especially around grief. Albertine, who he has a relationship with, modeled after Han, who was his driver, who was killed. But there's that lamentation and of course the death of his grandmother, which is probably modeled on the death of his mother, who was pretty much of a nervous breakdown after his mother died. Yeah. But he doesn't fear grieving. I thought this was brilliant. He fears the day he no longer grieves because the self that was once in love with those we lost no longer exists. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's one of the, we already alluded to the several small deaths, not in the sense of orgasms, but in the sense of falling out of love, with Gilbert in particular, that, so much surprise him, that make him really, I think, question the nature of love, that you can fall out of love with someone and sit in a room with them and be like, oh yeah, I used to be in love with this person, makes it seem very, fragile, and far from transcendental. And that seems to worry him a great deal. At the same time, it seems like, the love that he has for his grandmother is in some respects, of a different character than, these various romantic loves that he has, that the narrator has. And I don't, I should say incidentally that I'm not a Proust scholar. I'm a scholar of other things. And weirdly, since I started writing about Proust on Substack, I've had, journals send me requests to referee Proust scholarship. And I have to say, sorry, I'm not your guy. That's not my field. And in fact, for that reason, this helps to explain why I do not read secondary literature on Proust. I don't want to read it. I think it would make me fall out of love, so to speak. It would take away the magic if I learned, much more than I know about Proust's life. I know, at least, that the, female, love objects that are, that the narrator has are transformed versions of his own same-sex love objects. That much I know. But I don't know exactly how the transformation is affected. What I can say is that Marcel Proust, whatever his sexual orientation, is remarkably good at describing heterosexual desire and obsession. He's certainly capable of imagining his way into other people's desires. So that's just a little parenthesis. So this falling out of love is something that, again, seems to be I just read Mary Shelley, a lovely line. It's kind of a weaning from the things of this earth. And in that sense, a kind of rehearsal for death. And I think the narrator sees it this way. The question of whether the narrator ever experiences true love, or whether it's just, obsession, and I find the narrator rather morally abhorrent, someone who really never figures some basic things out about how to be good to other people. I think the whole fifth volume, the Prisoner, is just shocking.
No, it's just to interject there, which essentially Albertine becomes his lover, becomes his prisoner.
Yeah. And he's extremely sadistic, for no good reason, and doesn't seem to have any compunction about this. He doesn't seem to have any interest in his own moral growth. You might say that his attachment to his grandmother and, having to knock on the wall, this is an example you mentioned earlier, having to knock on the wall of the hotel, so that she'll hear him in his room and feeling reassured when he hears her knock back. That's already a bit like the relationship to Albertine, right? And yet, his love for his grandmother is in many respects, the best thing he's got going. And it is indeed very sad when she dies. Let me also add that there's another person towards whom the narrator is morally abhorrent, who I think is a really key figure for understanding the whole novel. She's kind of the backbone of the novel, and that's Françoise, the maid, the nanny, who is, of course, alive until the very end, witnesses it all, has a sort of wisdom that, that aristocrats can never have and that he can never have, and really, really holds things together. He's nasty to her too, but I think it's pretty clear he loves her.
Great. We're going to stop there. That was Justin E.H. Smith. You can find him on his Substack site, Internet. We were discussing Marcel Proust's great novel, In Search of Lost Time.
And the previous program was the Chris Hedges Report, heard Thursdays at 6:30 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. And before we go into Black Agenda Radio, by popular request, a number of y'all report came to me by phone and email saying that y'all want to hear a Thanksgiving prayer from William S. Burroughs once again. And who am I to deny that request? So, without further ado, I present again a Thanksgiving prayer by William S. Burroughs. Burroughs. I say with an S, Burroughs. So here we go.
For John Dillinger, in hope he is still alive. Thanksgiving Day, November 28th, 1986. Thanks for the wild turkey and passenger pigeons destined to be out through wholesome American guts. Thanks for a continent to despoil and poison. Thanks for Indians to provide a modicum of challenge and danger. Thanks for vast herds of bison to kill and skin, leaving